Welcome to our Core Christi monthly discussion. My name is Rachel Pachta, and I'm the Director of Ministry for the Missioners of Christ. Today I'm joined by my wonderful co-hosts, Angela Whitehouse and Kate Harmeyer, as we kick off our first episode on our new book study, The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. Today we're talking about some of the attachments that we're seeing from the characters in the first several chapters of the book, and also how much we love the solid people, the simplicity and the humility that they bring. We are so excited to get to share with you. So without further ado, here is our first discussion on The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. Okay, so Angela, tell us about your initial reaction to the first 1.5 pages of The Great Divorce. Go.
Okay, first of all, it wasn't 1.5 pages. It was maybe 1.5. I at least got to maybe chapter 2. But my initial response was, what the heck are we doing? And why are we doing this book? I was very skeptical. I've read C.S. Lewis before. And I was, it was just so different from what he has, what I'm familiar with his writings. And so I just didn't really, I didn't know what we were talking about when I started reading it. So I did send a little text message, maybe it was aggressive, to you all, why did we suggest
this? The worst book ever.
It was just kind of, it was more passive aggressive, more my style.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say, it was more like, laying down. Hey girls, I'm thinking maybe I'm not getting into this in the right way.
Exactly. It was way more
I
like that.
Literally nothing I can say about this on the podcast.
Right. It was definitely more passive. But it was the AKA, I don't like this and why are we doing it? But anyway, so that was my initial response to The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. As I started to read it, as I got on to probably chapter 4 was when I was like, oh, I see what we're doing here, Lewis, and I like it. And it started to click, and it started to become more of a story that I could understand and relate to. I think it honestly was because I actually really enjoy literature. I just didn't know that this book was that type of genre. And so now knowing that it is a story, I was able to understand, jump into it, and I now enjoy it. And I am very much enjoying the story of it. So
awesome.
Yeah. Well, glad you got on board.
Yes, I did.
Because this is one of my all-time favorite books. I buy it for people just randomly and give it to them as a gift. Like if you're getting confirmed, this is probably what I'm going to give you as your gift, because I just think it's such a beautiful fantasy, which is not a genre I usually like. But it's one of those books that you have to read in a different way, maybe than a lot of the books we have been reading together. And I found the preface to be incredibly helpful to me. I think the first time I read the book, I didn't read the preface first. And then the second time I did, and it was really illuminating, because even the title, like if you tell someone you're reading The Great Divorce, they kind of like look at you sideways, like, because the connotation, of course, of a great divorce is not great. But if you read the preface, he talks about how it's in response to another book that was written by someone that was called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And he's definitely responding with his very firmly held belief that you cannot kind of blend together heaven and hell. They are two distinct places and you have to make a choice for one or the other. That was really helpful to me to get into it, is like immediately like, okay, this is going to be making a commentary about this theological fact. And so let's see what happens with it. But yeah, it definitely, it creeps for a little while there where you're like, where are we going? Like, what are
this
we
is
doing?
So trippy. And then like they're on a bus in a gray town. And there's people in line, and there's really skinny people who you can't tell their gender, and then they like run away, and then there's like, oh, this, and they're on a bus, and then it's like tripping out, and then they're in another seat, and then there's people fighting, and then they arrive.
Yep.
It's like, and he can't touch the grass, and he's like walking on the grass, and then all of a sudden it starts to come together.
Mm-hmm. So, Ange, where did it start to come together for you?
I think it started to come together on chapter four, when I understood they were on a bus and that he had just seen hell, essentially. I didn't know it was hell, it was the town. And then kind of the contrast of that, where he was going another place. And so I started to see, okay, we have this, like, the theme that stood out to me initially was the contrast of the isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, isolation versus communal.
Yes.
And that's when I was hooked. I was like, this is good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm so glad you brought up that point, because this time around, this is my third time reading the book. And I was particularly struck by the isolation versus communal element of it, because when I read it the first time, there were some other things, honestly, that I identified with. But this time around, it was definitely that. And it was like right off the bat, and something that was really almost like periphery to me last time, like the isolation, and like the isolation, especially of Napoleon, and like how people fight and then they move away. Because I've been really convicted of growing in friendship. And this is a place I think it's especially appropriate in Queer Christy to talk about friendship, because it is so easy to fight and the way I heard it actually put by someone in a podcast that was like discussing friendship was, it is so much easier to kill and walk away. Kill the friendship, walk away. Like, you get to that point, kill the friendship, walk away. Like, just, but what is that doing? It's separating, separating, separating. There's nobody you will ever not have tension with. There's nobody who will ever not at some point rub you the wrong way. Right? Mm-hmm. So, but I loved that. And it was like, you know, those in hell. And one thing about this book is that it's really a good demonstration of the choices that we make in our life, because we begin on this road of hell. And so it was a really good examination of conscience for me, of thinking like, am I acting like those in the gray town, or those who want to go up the mountain, communal, or am I killing and whacking away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And the contrast between the gray town, where they're moving farther and farther apart, and then when we get to heaven, when we get to that space, how people are coming towards them to greet mm-hmm. them and walk with them. And so you can just see that we were meant to be in community. Like, they're coming towards the bus mm-hmm. with open arms as you get there. I thought that was really striking this time that I looked at it. I love where he talks about kind of one of the main themes of the book being that it's not as if we're all gradually going to the same place if we stay on our path. It's that evil cannot just morph into good, but it can be undone. But the only way to undo it is to go back and start again on the correct path. That I just thought that was really, really poignant. It's hopeful and challenging at the same time. Evil will not develop into good. In the very preface, it says, if we insist on keeping hell or even earth, we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest and most intimate souvenirs of hell. So I thought that was just really the right kind of gut punch to say there is good and there is evil. We must make a choice for one or the other. But also it can very easily happen that we're not aware of the choices we're making along the way and where they're taking us. Yeah. But when we have that wake up call, the hopeful moment is you can go back and start again.
Yeah.
Yeah. From the very beginning of the book, he is saying we can't muddle these two things.
Yeah.
We can justify them to ourselves, but there is still a distinction between goodness and evil, heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why he was like this. What in the preface he says, we want to marry heaven and hell. Like, what was that? Who is the philosopher? Gosh, I don't even know.
Blake.
Yes. Okay. And how he wrote about the marriage of heaven and hell. Like, it's all together. It's whatever you want it to be. It's your truth. You know, I guess that's how it would kind of like how it's basically passed down through society mm-hmm. in terms. That's why these philosophers are so important. The culture that we're swimming in is was built on the ideas of philosophers that really took root and became fads. Okay, so we've got to be really aware of whatever ideology our culture is swimming in, because that's really what's going on. What was the character that stood out to you guys the most? Let's say the first like few chapters, the first couple of characters that popped up. Who was it that you were like, oh yeah?
The big guy was really that in the exchange between the big guy is what I'm calling him, the big man.
Yeah. The one who wants his rights.
Who wants his rights? I just want what is owed to me. I never asked anything free. I don't need bleeding charity. That guy. He stands out to me a lot. And then the other is kind of tying to what you were talking about, Rachel, the man that he's, later on, we find out he's an Episcopal bishop of some variety, but he's kind of initially the guy in he's like described as a fat, clean shaven man, but that exchange, it is so much C.S. Lewis going to town on the ideology of the day, of the fad philosophy of the day that you were just referencing, right? Where let's look at, well, what really does eternity mean? And what do you mean? You know, in your life, you became so narrow-minded at the end. I have to have free play of the mind, like that guy. So those would be the two that I really, the exchanges were like, you're like almost watching someone play ping pong, like back and forth, kind of seeing how that played out. And you're like cringing the whole time, but it's also so truthful.
Yeah.
I think the one that I really thought was really interesting was that the guy, the clean shaven, I guess he's like Episcopal bishop. Is that what
he's a bishop. He earns his bishop appointment.
Bishopric.
Is that real?
It's a real word. I don't know any of those kinds of words, you guys. I'm like, because of his liberal ideology. What would be classified as like his kind of liberal, what he calls, C.S. Lewis calls like just that, the being at the forefront of the liberal movement is what I think he kind of referred to with him. And that it was, you know, writing those papers, and it started small. It was like writing those papers in college, because those were the ones that would get you the A. And then moving, because that's what was in, and then moving forward. And that's essentially how he, keep going.
I was just going to say my favorite interaction with that specific character, probably the most, when I say favorite, cringy. Yeah. What was when he had invited him to actually meet the Lord. He was like, just come with me to meet the one that you're talking about. And he starts to make up these excuses, and he says, you know, actually, I actually can't come with you. I have to be back next Friday to read a paper. We have a little theological society down there. Oh yes, there's plenty of intellectual life. And that it was so cringy to really think about how often we have an opportunity to encounter the living God, and our response is like, actually, like, I'm trying to get this thing happening, or just trying to, where we put the intellectual side, or the ministry, or the whatever it might be that we think is such a good.
Yeah.
And we have blocked the actual encounter with Jesus.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes. And it's painful to watch, because you can feel it coming. And it's really painful to watch the ghosts, as it will, is what they end up being called, find a reason to go back to the bus. Mm-hmm. Like they, when they finally click in their mind, like, oh, that's my excuse. And they're like, they're happy to have it, so that they can go back to what they know, or the place where they think they have some control. The quote that you talked about that from that section was on 39, that really just like, it was hard to get through. It was the bright person or saying to him, you have seen hell, you are inside of heaven. Will you even now repent and believe?
Wow.
And, you know, and he's like, well, I'll consider it. Like, he starts to kind of go into that language. Like, I'll have to have some assurances. Like, I need to be sure that, like, he's making demands of heaven.
Yeah.
So, so that it will meet his expectations and be a place he would like to spend eternity.
Yeah. Gosh. I like a place worthy of him in a way.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I'm not an uber intellectual like him, but that character led me to a lot of examination of my wants, my preferences. Is that what it, because it could be any kind of preferences or attachment. Is he's being invited to let go of his attachment to his own ego in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all are, but it's a different form. It's whatever form that pride is taking place. Like for the big man, it was, if we can talk about him for a second, the big man who wants his rights, he stood out to me a lot this time because it was like he felt like I've lived a good life and I've earned it. And then this you know, saint who comes out to him is like, who had murdered someone and he couldn't believe he was there. And it was like he'd received mercy and he was so appalled that that person was there and had received mercy and was coming down to greet him. And the humility that this saint had, like, no, I'm coming because, like, I want to serve you. I want to serve you for however long. Like, this is my penance. This is my way because I killed you in my mind so many times. Mm-hmm. But the big man saying, like, what's the point of all of this if I have to be up there with the likes of you? But the thing is, like, we can't have, it's a good reminder, like, we can't have anything like that we're hanging on to get into heaven. Like, there's no grudges or no held on, like, pride over the other. And we'll be so surprised at who is going to be there with us in the body of Christ. And we've got to be able to let go of any sense of superiority. I was really convicted by that too.
Yeah, the sense of entitlement is completely gone because we are all put on the level of adopted sons and daughters of Christ. And regardless of how this man who had kept saying, you know, his rights and what he had deserved and he wanted this, and how those were the things that ended up crippling his soul to actually accept God's grace, mm-hmm. to actually accept like the gift.
Sorry. It felt like the laborers in the vineyard.
Yeah.
He was like, I've been here working all day long.
Yeah.
And this guy comes in at 5 o'clock and gets the same thing I'm owed. Like, I don't want to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. And in that he kind of, I noted that on page 28, and the saint says to him, I haven't got my rights or I should not be here, and you will not get yours either. You'll get something far better. And the guy's like, I don't want your bleeding charity. And he's like, ask for bleeding charity. Everything is here for the asking and nothing can be bought.
Yes, that's one of my favorite lines. Everything is here for the asking and nothing can be bought. And I think that's the question is, like, are we willing to accept that that is actually what salvation is? Like, everything is here for the asking. He is ready to redeem me entirely, to fill all things. I was reading and praying through Ephesians today. It's like, you know, so that Christ could fill all things. He went to hell and he went to heaven. He filled all things for us. But it's his work and he earned it. We didn't. And we can't do it on our own. Abraham was in hell, the land of the dead, whatever. Abraham was there. You know, David was there. No one earns it. We have to have it from the Lord, and we have to receive it as the poor. Because if we don't receive it that way, then we can't have it. We can't buy it.
And this idea of earning it is just so contrary. And at the end of this one, he comes up with his excuse too. The big man, you know, he basically at the end, he senses again, he has a choice. He has a semblance of control where he was like, oh, well, I've now got a good reason not to come because you're there.
Yeah.
Like, and therefore this place is not what it should be. Like, I'm going home. Like it says at the end there, it says, the narrator says, I thought there was a kind of triumph in his voice. It had been entreated. It could make a refusal. And this seemed to be a kind of advantage. Mm-hmm. How they all just find, like, in the face of heaven, we all do this every day. In the face of heaven, we're like, I actually, I think I'm going to go back. Like, I actually, I think I'm going to do this thing instead. Or actually, I think I'm going to, you know, prioritize this. It's just like that to me. That's why I love this book so much. I could just talk about it forever. Just the way that it, like, it holds up a mirror and you can see yourself in this ghastly thing and not despair because it's a fantasy, but also you can be so instructed.
Well, what you were just saying, Kate, before your mic cut out, I'm just going to read that. I'm going to steal that thunder for a second.
Go ahead.
Peter Kreeft, because it's so good. So he said, this was in a meditation that I read from him. I read, we pray, my husband and I read Food for the Soul. I think this is the title of the book. It's like his reflections on each of the readings. It's amazing. It's from Word on Fire. But he had this quote in one of the meditations, and it said, great novelists do that. They show us who we are by showing us fictional characters. We think we're staring at a picture, and we find we are staring in a mirror. That was from the 11th Sunday of Easter, if anybody ever wants to like look that up. But it's definitely a great way to – ooh, he goes pretty deep too. C.S. Lewis does. Like, it's pretty – he's really poignant in kind of nailing the sin that these people have. And in a way where I'm like, yeah, I kind of seen that. Like, let me sit back for a second. Like, have I seen this in myself? So – okay, can I take an alternate route though? I really love the input from the solid people, you know, like their freedom. It's like that when they're speaking versus the spirit speaking, there's such an air of freedom in them and of self-forgetfulness and pure love. Like, this is someone, especially the one who came out to meet the big man, like, this is someone who hated him when he was on earth and had to repent of it, clearly. And he did repent of it and repented of murder and repented of, you know, and then the love that he has in his heart and the humility and single-heartedness towards the Lord, that it's like a breath of fresh air to see the contrast. And to be reminded of being minded like the solid people, and that they're the ones who are really actually living.
Mm. You know, they're closer to reality. They're living in reality, and all the literary devices that he uses to make that point that they are solid. There is this exposing light. Like, I think when you were reading that mirror quote, I was just thinking about CS is just putting this all in the light. And we're having to see, it's like they call it a cruel light. We're having to see ourselves in this cruel light. But the fact that even if you look at the way their speech patterns go, the ghosts, when they start talking, they go on and on and on and on and on and on. It's very talking about their lives, and it's very circular, and the passages tend to be pretty long, or it's a very direct, like kind of quippy sort of thing. Whereas when the saints talk or the solid people talk, they're incredibly direct, incisive, and just what they say is solid.
Right.
Like I'm looking at 40, and it says when he's talking to the guy who was the Episcopal intellectual, right? And he's kind of making demands of him. And he's saying, I'll need to have free play of the mind and an intellectual life in heaven and some influence. And the saint says to him, I can promise you none of these things. No sphere of influence. You are not needed there at all.
Aren't needed.
Mm-hmm. No scope for your talents, only forgiveness for having perverted them. No atmosphere of inquiry, for I will bring you to the land, not of questions, but of answers, and you shall see the face of God. Mm. The weight of their words, even, and the shortness of the sentences, like it's such a beautiful juxtaposition. And also they don't talk about themselves at all, except to be in potentially drawing that other person along.
Yeah. Rather say things like, okay, we don't have to go into all of that now. Like, it's okay. We don't have to go back to that. We can just go up the mountain. Just forget. Like, it's pointless to mull that over again. We're just going to go up the mountain. Will you just come with me?
Yeah.
And if we must talk about it, it's like, who is the one who is like, he was kind of like forced into talking about something. Like, sometimes they're like, okay, well, if we have to, then I will explain to you this thing. But it's like, let's just go up the mountain. We're kind of wasting time. Mm-hmm. We need to go.
I think it was the guy with the big man. I think it was in that exchange. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did have a question about the environment, like the scenery, and how I think it just, it was a little bit confusing. Well, I guess I'd just love to hear what you guys thought about it. When it was like when the waterfall talked.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, the angel who looked like he was being crucified.
And I guess just if Kate, I know you've kind of read this a few times, if you could just talk a little bit about the like the actual place and like some of the like what they were looking at and why it was how it was.
It's hard because I'm not there's some of the stuff that I still am kind of unpacking. I think the waterfall angel is one of the harder ones. I'm closer to having like my mind wrap around that not being totally bizarre, because when you think of the descriptions of actual angels and what they looked like, they're pretty far out there. So a waterfall angel is actually probably closer to my ability to envision an angel that's not just like the one we draw for our Christmas pictures, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it was an interesting way of saying that the spiritual, the angelic, the supernatural is just a part of the environment there.
Okay.
Like it is the nature of the place down to the features, that it's just of a different substance, character, and weight, because it is actual truth, actual reality. Mm-hmm. Whereas everything from the gray town lacks substance because it lacks connection to reality itself and truth itself. I'm not going to say I understand the lions. I don't know what they're doing.
Were they like dancing? They were like dancing lion? Or something. Yeah. I feel like he kind of just had to put lions in there. Like just kill the Narnia, right? Was everyone just like, oh, shout out Aslan.
And there are, yes, indeed, there are lions in this story.
Yeah, I kind of love that part. But I think you're right. With the environment, it's like even the grass itself and even the bushes and even the trees, I almost got a sense of this fulfillment too of the garden, right? Like where it's like, this is the fulfillment of Eden, where everything is solid, everything is purposeful, like everything that breathes praises the Lord.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I noticed about the scenery is that there's this contrast between, you know, the main character is like, this is so unbelievably beautiful. This is so beautiful. Everything looks amazing. Everything sounds amazing. It's, you know, sounds of joy and everything, but it's like beyond his perception. And it's really hard for him himself to like live in it. And that's kind of like the spiritual life. In the beginning, there's times as we're being redeemed and we're being really brought to life, that birthing process of sanctification can be really painful sometimes. Yeah. And it might take a while, whereas, you know, with certain virtues that we might be trying to grow in, like let's say someone struggles with gossip. Okay, let's say someone struggles with gossip. It might be really hard in the beginning to kind of like do some violence to that vice, so that it can feel like a pain is being taken away, like a conviction, and then like a training in the habit, so that the words that we speak are blessing and not curses, and in like we're moving in the direction. But in a year, or even in like a couple months, or maybe like 10 confessions later, we're running in that virtue. You know, like we're seeing the fruit of sanctification in that. That is, I love the contrast of that, of like as people are kind of entering this heavenly place, mm-hmm. that they can't quite live in it yet, but they are allowed to live in it. They're invited to live in it. They're wanted, but it's going to take some time. And even a little bit of the time while he's there, he's noticing that his perception is able to take it in a little bit more, but it's still painful.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked that too.
Yeah, that's a great point. Almost like this, it's a spiritual awakening. It's allowing ourselves to be made whole. And that is painful, that process of virtue and growing in virtue. It's like we can, ideally, we could know it. Like, I know I'm not supposed to do this. But then actually living out and practically living in that virtue and practicing it, yeah, there's a painful element to it. And then we are purified.
Yeah. And it's awkward too. Like there's pain, but it's also just awkward. There was that that guy who was trying to gather the apple so that he could have something to sell because he thought he could fix hell.
Oh, right.
If he could just have something to sell, then people would have to form a community and that would be better. And all of those things, like the way he was like going from place to place and hiding behind trees and crawling along and the breeze was hurting him and all of those things. It's just awkward too, you know, like when we're holding on to things. So when we start to take those first steps in holiness, it's painful. It's a purgative process, really. And then it's also just, it's so far out of the rut of our life that we've made that we almost feel we have to so intentionally step because mm-hmm. our pattern would be to just fall back into what we were doing before.
Yeah. Like, just go back to the bus.
Just go back. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Like that is so much, it doesn't seem like they have any trouble getting back to the bus.
Yeah. Well, and there's the one guy now, I don't know if I'm jumping too far ahead. But how far into the chapter is the guy who's like, do you really believe what's going on here?
Yeah, that's 7. I've gotten there.
We can't even, if we want to talk about that guy, he's the one who kind of almost gets the, you know, this main character. Because he's like, yeah, it's all a scheme.
All very skeptical. Like, just is so, he was so hard for me. I don't like people like that. I was like, what? No, come on. Like, just so.
Working for the man.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so, like, I honestly picked him. Like, I pictured this guy, like, kind of on the side smoking cigarettes in heaven. No. Like, just like, hey, buddy, step over here. Like, just dirty, swanky.
What's going on here?
Yeah, just the skepticism, pessimist. What happened to him? I actually can't remember.
They call him the hard-bitten ghost. That's what he ends up being called. And he's also kind of like, I've been here and I've been there. I've traveled the world.
I was like,
he's like Paris, flop.
Yeah.
You know, like Rome, been there, done that, tourist trap. He's like heaven, flop.
like just not impressed with anything.
I think in him is this, now I think I'm talking about the right person. I mean, you're going to have to forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think that he's the one who says, what's the point of being here anyway? We can't even like eat the food or, you know, what is that? That's like a deep despair is what he really is working with. It's like this, and that's one of that is the deadliest sin, is like that deep despair of like, well, what's even the point? Because I'm unredeemable. There's no way that I would ever be able to interact in this place, on this mm-hmm. heavenly realm. Mm-hmm. And does anybody even come up to him?
Well, the narrator does. I don't know yet, because he was kind of at the end. I don't know if we're going to see him again. I can't remember.
Okay.
But he passes it on. He gives the narrator like contact depression because he just like leaves that like, oh gosh, I didn't really think about the fact that the rain would like pierce me like bullets. Like, you know, he like passes all of that skepticism onto him so easily, and even makes, I think, the narrator feel like a little silly that he didn't think of it himself.
Yeah.
And he also does that thing, which Angela, I'm with you, these kinds of people, but like he does that thing where he's like, wait a second. Why do we have to acclimate to this place? You're all powerful. Management should make the place acclimate to us. You know, that whole thing, like, oh, forget our feet getting harder. Make the grass softer.
Right.
Yeah. Again, hell was a flop. Heaven's a flop too. Like, you know, I didn't like it down there and I don't like it here either. But at least down there, I can eat the food and I can walk around.
Yeah. Well, and like, how much of that is like, oh, this church teaching's too hard. Why don't they ease it up on us? Don't they know that it's the modern day?
Oh.
I mean, but really, if we're talking, I mean.
That's exactly,
That was a hot take right there. That was good.
That was a good one. I would drop my mic, but then I wouldn't be able to continue.
It's so true. No, it say more, true. Rachel, because that's really, really true.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that stuff's not applicable to us now. The church needs to, you know, get around to it, you know, the modern times and get with it,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've advanced like past those views.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about the Israelites in the desert when, because of course I'm always thinking about the Israelites in the desert. When they're like, at least in Egypt, we had food. You brought us out here and we're starving. You know, again, like that kind of idea of like, what I knew was better. I don't want to change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was comfy.
Yep. And then I think this one is just, he's just stuck. Like I guess I know why they call him the bitter ghost, the hard bitten ghost. Because as a person like that, it's not only that you don't want to change, you want someone to make a change for you. And you're just stuck in this one way of thinking, unimpressed by everything. And you're just living your life in that. It's sad. He made me sad. I felt like the narrator. I was like, yeah, this is kind of hard.
Yeah. Well, but to be mindful too, that if we're putting ourselves in the narrator, she's like, he's making progress towards acclimating to this heavenly place, right? So he's not like the others were like, oh, this place is horrible for this, that, or the other reason. I'm going to go back. Forget that. He's like, man, I'm like, this is really beautiful. And this is, you know, man, it's really hard to walk in it, but maybe if I come over here, I can make it a little bit further, you know, and I'm, you know, taking in the place and kind of in a way contemplating it and being mindful that there are people who can come along the road and do this to us and to be on our guard against it. Mm-hmm. Because he walked away almost losing his, he's like, no. That was like a little spiritual attack that kind of happens to him. Mm-hmm. In on his walk towards the mountain, as he's really starting to make maybe a little bit of progress, maybe he's kind of like got his toe in the door. And then in comes the cynic who's like, let me kill that pride. Let me kill that joy a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a really good insight. Cause there's something in the description of that man where the narrator even said like, it's the kind of guy I naturally admire. I naturally listen to or something like that. That's a very good point to just be on guard on our spiritual walk for those things that we know cause us to fall into despair or skepticism. Right. When, you know, the teachings of the church are hard to live.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, that say like, it's hard to live because you shouldn't be doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you know, we all know the person who's going to tell us maybe a confirmation bias. Like we all know the person who's going to tell us what we want to hear. So deciding to either steer clear from that person in a sensitive time, maybe knowing our limits on like, who can I really interact with? Like at this point in my life, like, is this what the Lord is calling me to do? Or do I need to maybe take a charitable step back for a minute and check who I am choosing to be around, who's going to be leading me, you know, closer to the Lord. Mm-hmm. And this book, like kind of closer up the mountain. So
mm-hmm. That's good advice.
Because evil, as we know, evil is evil. Like they talk about this, evil doesn't. It's not gonna turn into good. Mm-mm. And there's no like roundabout, self-tailored, preferential way to heaven that is like your special route, while everybody else has to take a different route. Like it's everyone's on. You got to go back to the right place and go up the way that the Lord has designed. And so. I hope that made sense.
Mm-hmm. Definitely did. It's a good full circle there to like what he says he wants this book to do for us is to show us that there's the mountains and we can walk towards them. But we can't walk back to the bus and expect to end up at the mountains. Like there's a direction we need to be headed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it may be the case that, you know, it's difficult at times or we run into the sky, like smoking a cigarette against a tree and we spend a period of time in that place with that person. But ultimately you got to get back on the path that goes to the mountains. Like that's the place that you're headed. You can't just wander about and expect to arrive there.
Yeah. And we can kind of take a deep breath and say, okay, I'm not far away from it. In any moment I can choose to get back on the path. Anytime that I know for me personally, like I've kind of had to learn this habit because I have struggled with scrupulosity and despair before. Like I had to train myself to, when I felt convicted and authentically convicted of a sin, it gave me hope because the Lord was revealing it to me. And then I could just take it to confession, and I knew that he wasn't going to leave me on my own to fix it. That he, like, as long as my heart was open and I had that, what is it, the bloody dog of goodwill? Didn't we have that in a book? Who, mm-hmm, which book was that one? Yeah, the blood, that yeah, bloody dog of goodwill. That's mm-hmm, you know, inconquerable. And so, you know, remembering that too, like if those who are listening right now, you'd be like, oh yeah, I know I'm on the wrong path and it's kind of hurting to listen to some of this, but honestly, I don't know what I can do. Maybe I should go back and get on the bus. Don't get on the bus. So it's okay. And like the solid people are saying, like, it's just like another hour. Just give yourself another hour, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can lean on me. Yeah. And you'll barely have to touch the ground. Like, I can't, there's one that says, I can't carry you entirely, but you can lean on me and your feet will barely touch the ground. Like,
yeah. Give it 3 hours. You won't even remember this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I started doing it after you did it, Rachel, but like, I loved how you called them saints because that's what they are. And yeah, when you think of there being, you know, saints that obviously these were people from their lives, and hopefully, you know, we'll meet lots of people from our lives when we, God willing, get to heaven. But to think like we might have these saint friends, mm-hmm, there are these saint friends who are willing to like help carry us along the way and intercede for us along the way, where we know of our own failings. And I just find that to be great. Like, again, like that image of like, they're running to the bus. Like, they're running to the bus to greet you, mm-hmm, if you'll just walk with them. They're there. And I think that's one of the cool things. I know that, you know, our friend Clive Staples was not Catholic in his life, but man, does he write like one, because, mm-hmm, you know, you see that he's bringing all of this supernatural stuff just into the air, you know, saints and angels, and later on more demonic thing. Like, you're gonna, like, it's all there. And also it's such a beautiful meditation on purgatory, mm-hmm, and how eternity kind of works forwards and backwards. Mm-hmm. And that if you choose heaven, you know, any trials that you have been through will have been purgatory. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you choose hell, everything you've been through will just have been like another part of hell.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Man, look at us. Usually right about now is when our microphones are finally resolved.
Right. I mean, I literally last month when we recorded, at this point, we finally started the podcast. We pressed play.
Yes.
First recorded.
Yes.
And yes, thanks for sticking with the book, Angela.
Hey, you're welcome. I'm very glad that I did.
We're proud of you, skeptical
readers out there. Keep going. It is very good. I don't want to be the guy with the cigarette saying like, I don't like the grapes of Voss. You know, like, I'm so glad I moved past him.
Stick with it. We can't even read the metaphors.
I don't understand this. I don't know. I'm so glad I said that. Thanks, guys. Thank you all.
All right. Well, until next time.